In a moment, another program in the continuing series of national town meetings. The topic of this national town meeting, television, American dream or nightmare. The principal speakers will be Senator John Pastore, Democrat from Rhode Island, and TV critic Sandra Van Oker. Following the initial presentations, members of the audience will have the opportunity to present questions to the speakers. These national town meetings are aimed at presenting distinguished figures from various walks of life, discussing with you, our radio audience, and with the audience assembled here at the Kennedy Center, some of the most vital topics of the day. And now the moderator of this national town meeting, Bonnie Angelo of Time Magazine.
Welcome to National Town Meeting. As you heard, our topic today is television, American dream or nightmare. This is an issue on which every American is an expert. Television, for better or worse, is part of our daily lives. In less than 25 years, it has vastly influenced our thinking and has altered our patterns of living. The question before us now is whether this total immersion in television has been a boon to knowledge, bringing the world and indeed outer space into every living room, or has it been a pervasive, unsettling force that has, in some cases, warped the traditional American sense of values and controlled attitudes? To examine television and its influence, we have a panel of two, each with long personal experience in dealing with this powerful medium, two from very different bases. First, Senator John Pastore, who has rounded out 42 years of public service, 26 of them as Democratic senator from the state of Rhode Island. In his long and distinguished Senate career, Senator Pastore has become internationally recognized as an expert in the field of nuclear energy, and is a member of the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy. He's also a senior member of the Powerful Appropriations Committee. But it is his place on the Senate Commerce Committee which has caused him to keep a watchful eye on the television industry. As chairman of the Subcommittee on Communications, he has been concerned both with the governmental aspects and licensing, regulation, and the consumer's concern about programming and content. He was author of the controversial Fairness Doctrine and has since perhaps changed his position. Senator Pastore, we're ready to hear your introductory statement on television, American dream or nightmare.
Well, as a starter, let me say, I like television. With all its faults, I like television. Will you ever forget in 1969, when Neil Armstrong was coming down on that ladder to put his foot on the moon, we all held our breaths. Then again, when the Viking landed on Mars, and two Sundays ago, when I turned on Channel 2 in Providence, and I saw the Boston Pops under the leadership of Arthur Fiedler, and there was Roberta Peters, and there was Robert Merrill. Now that's the fulfillment of the American dream. That's where television has played an aesthetic, edifying function in our daily lives. But in 1960, in 1 week, the public was fed to 144 murders, 13 kidnappings, I don't know how many tortures, and that was television at its worst. So it all depends what you're looking at. It all depends the kind of the program that they give us. So today, in discussing whether or not it is the fulfillment of the American dream or a nightmare, I think that we have to analyze whose responsibility it is. Under the Communications Act of 1934, we have no right to censor. We do not choose to censor. No one wants to do anything with an interference with the First Amendment of the Constitution, the freedom of speech. But on the other hand, this is a responsibility that belongs to the broadcasting industry. They've gone a long, long ways. They have not achieved the millennium. Maybe they never will. But after all, we have oversight, authority, and responsibility over the television industry. And we're going to exercise it. As I've said 100 times before, I can bark, but I can't bite. And as long as I'm the chairman of the Communications Committee, my voice is going to be heard, and they're going to clean up the garbage.
Our other panelist for this town meeting is Sander Van Oker, who knows television as a performer, as a professor, and as a critic. For 15 years, Sandy Van Oker was a correspondent for NBC News. He was in Washington covering national affairs and specifically the White House. Later, he was co-anchorman for Impact, public television's national news and public affairs program. For the past year, he has been chief television critic and editor of television news for the Washington Post. He also teaches communications at Duke University. Mr. Van Oker, from all this experience, give us a two-minute position of your news of television dream or nightmare.
I will, but I want 15 minutes extra. Which I'd like to pay tribute to Senator Pastore. I use this word carefully, not casually. He has been a great senator by his dedication, his intelligence, and his industry. He has, I believe, set a standard that equals the service of former great senators like the late Richard Russell of Georgia and Clinton Anderson of New Mexico. And I am truly honored to be here. My 2 minutes starts right now. A television critic has been described as someone who comes down from the mountain after the battle and shoots the wounded. I now turn psychiatrist. I don't think television is a nightmare at all. It is an unfulfilled dream. E.B. White, I think in 1938, talked about it in The New Yorker as having the possibility of a dream. You cannot decide, however, whether it is a nightmare or a dream because you really have no basis of comparison. You have in this country a totally dominant commercial system of television, which I, for one, do not intend to use as a whipping boy, as some kind of a electronic foundation garment that is designed to uplift and to shape and to mold our sagging cultural and aesthetic values. What you have to do is to try to understand what you don't see. And by that, you have to go to at least two countries in this world, Britain and Japan. I lived in Britain as a student and as a journalist. Commercial television was just starting out in the early 50s. I've been back since. It is a good system. But don't misunderstand from what you see in terms of Nova and Masterpiece Theatre that that is the bulk of British television, either BBC or the commercial networks. They have as many dogs on as we do. In February, I went to Japan to look at their system. The Japanese have a commercial system and NHK, which has two channels, one general and one educational. It is free of government control. It is sponsored to a certain extent, like the BBC is, by a fee system on television sets. And that system reflects, and it's in its charter, the cultural values of the nation. You really have to go to Japan, and even if you can't understand the language, look at the listings and look at what you see on both channels to understand what you're missing in America. I think that the problem we have in this country with television is that commercial television really has no competition. The three networks do not compete with each other. They say they do. And every year, one will lead the other in the ratings. But they are all turning over, in the words of Larry Gelbart, who formerly produced and wrote MASH, the same compost heap. I don't use that word entirely in a derogatory manner, because you have to have compost to make things grow. I think television is a good deal better now than it's been in the past. But I think it is no way near becoming the dream that we wish it to be, because it is not challenged. I think public broadcasting has not challenged it. for a lot of complicated reasons, which I'll be glad to explain if anybody wants to ask me about it. I think the only way television is going to change is if we establish in this country alternate forms, whether that's pay cable or a strengthened public broadcasting. I don't really think, though I sat yesterday listening to pay cable arguments before Congressman Van Dierlen's committee, that the issue is one that's going to be decided by pay cable or by commercial television. The issue has been decided that we're going to get alternate forms of television in this country. And two things have decided it. One, the marketplace is there, and that, in my judgment, is the best way to decide it. And secondly, the technology is there. They have the means now, through fibrous cable, through satellites, to bring more forms of television into the household. So television will change. I do not know if it will change for the better, but it's going to change. And if alternate forms change, then I think commercial television will have to change simply to meet the competition.
Thank you. Now it is your turn to question our speakers. When you go to the microphones, please give your name, where you're from, and to whom you're addressing questions. There are microphones on the far left and the far right aisles. I hope a lot of you will make use of those, but also we've got the cards going through the audience. But while you're finding your way to the mics, I'd like to start the questioning. Senator Pastore, you and Sandy Van Oker have taken opposite views from time to time on this question of the family hour. I'd like to have both of you just explain your position. Sandy, you've been quite sharp in some of your criticisms of Family Hour, and Senator Pastore, I think you've defended it quite strongly. I'd like to know the whys and wherefores.
Well, I don't think that this was the predicate for it, but for a long, long time, my committee has been receiving letters by the thousands from mothers, families, complaining about the excessive violence on television. Now, you got to realize that television is a very impressive thing, especially when it comes to young people who are very impressionable to begin with. And the selling of an idea is one of the things that television is accomplishing. And an idea can be good or it can be bad. The way you can sell soap, you can sell a bad idea as well. So we've been complaining about this. And we've been getting after the industry from time to time as they came before our committee, because after all, we do have oversight responsibility. And we have been instilling into their minds, or at least trying to, that it's their responsibility to serve the public interest. Now, I guess that as a result of much of this background, the matter was discussed by the FCC, and then the broadcasting industry on its own initiative. I had nothing to do with it. I never heard about the Family Hour until it was published by the Broadcasting Association and the networks. And I think that the Family Hour is a step in the right direction. Now, the contention is made that it leads to bland programming. Well, I don't think so. You take the Mary Tyler Moore Show. You take the Waltons. You take the Jeffersons. Good Times. I mean, there are many, many programs that really could edify, educate our people. You take, as I mentioned, the Boston Pops. There are many, many fine things that can be done. Now, the purpose of the Family Hour was to serve the family for those 2 hours between 7 and 9. Now, I realize that many of the producers are finding fault with this, and there are many people who are opposed to it, and I give them credit for their sincerity, and I respect their point of view. But the whole purpose behind it was to serve the family, and that's the reason why they inaugurated the Family Hour, and I approve of it. And I think time will be necessary to judge whether it's right or wrong.
My opposition is totally political and not cultural. The Congress, especially the House Subcommittee on Appropriations, asked Wiley, the chairman of the FCC, Richard Wiley, what he was going to do about sex, and the phrase wasn't violence, it was mostly radio-oriented sex, those topless shows. This was several summers ago. Wiley said and felt and perceived correctly that Congress was disturbed about the problem of sex and violence on television. My objection to it is that I thought it brought the networks and the government through the FCC into an area that I want the government to stay out of, which is content. If we didn't learn anything from the Nixon years, and I speak as someone who I think learned something from those years in terms of White House interference in broadcasting, or attempts at it, we should have learned that government should stay away from the First Amendment and free expression, except to guarantee our right to have it. I think it set a precedent that if the government, however tenuously, encouraged the networks, met, as Wiley did, with the officials of the three networks in his office to talk about doing something about television violence, then I think that if they do it in that area, then why can't they do it in news? So I think that violence should be lessened on television. I think the marketplace should have decided, as it is deciding it now, because commercial advertisers are taking their spots away from unduly violent shows. Fine, let the marketplace decide it. I don't want the government in even an inch.
May I make a rejoinder to that? Well, I go along with everything that Sandy said, but there is another thing, such as responsibility. And the question here is that these people do obtain a license, that the airwaves are limited as to who should get it, and that the law provides that they should serve the public interest. Now, realizing the complaints that we received, and I say by the thousands, in 1969, we appropriated $1 million at my behest in order to have the best minds in America. I'm talking about anthropologists, psychiatrists, psychologists, sociologists, to make an in-depth scientific study as to what was the relationship between violence on television and the behavior of children. In 1972, the Surgeon General of the United States appeared before my committee, and this is the report. The causal relationship between televised violence and antisocial behavior is sufficient to warrant appropriate and immediate remedial action. Not too long ago in Boston, three young hoodlums seized this girl and made her douse herself with kerosene, throw a match at her, and burned her alive. And that same incident was shown on Fuzz 3 days before. Now, if you don't think that that is of concern to a member who's elected to serve the people of the country, then I don't know why I'm in the Senate of the United States.
And now it's time to go to our audience for questions. Gentleman on my left.
My name is Anson Corder. I am a retired federal employee, and about 50 years ago, a half miler at the University of Illinois. I have a double question on the Olympics, brief. One, is it necessary almost daily to take time out to advertise the station's own soap opera about a couple of men browbeating or smacking around a woman? Two, is it smart for the executives with the advertisers to sit in their hotel rooms, probably watching their own advertisements, instead of giving away their freebies to people who are claiming to get in outside from the outside when there are empty seats quite visible on the inside?
To whom do you direct that?
Either one of them.
Either one. Sandy, you want to take that one?
That's your First Amendment, Sandy. Yeah.
They have a perfect right within the system we have, and there is a limitation on how many commercials can be put in a commercial half-hour program. Yes, they have the perfect right to put on anything they want, consistent with taste and decency. As to the second question, I'm not sure, do they have the right to sit? Yes, they do have a right. They've got a right to...
I did not question their right. I questioned the listeners and the smart
Well, I can't get into that because, or won't, because it's a First Amendment question. Yes, I think that in terms of the system we have, they may be wise to advertise the shows that they have upcoming in the next season. Remember, when you say they, you have to differentiate. The networks have commercials, and then they switch away to local stations where they put in their own commercials. If you're going to believe in the First Amendment, then you've got to say they have the right, and by their sights, they have the wisdom to do whatever they want.
Can I follow that up?
Certainly.
I got to read a letter that I received the other day. It was dated July the 12th. The Honorable John Pastore, United States Senate. Dear John, it's one of these Dear John letters. I know there is not a thing in the world you can do about this, but while I was stretched out on my back trying to get over a hip operation, I was watching what was being offered on July 4th, our birthday, on television. What you saw was an occasional flag, an occasional ship, an occasional reading by some poet. But what you saw 90% of the time was the dumbest assortment of cheap advertising I've ever looked at in my life. It just seems strange to me that companies who get the right to harass their fellow citizens with a license that has cost them nothing might have been able to have gone one full day, the 4th of July, without advertising dog food, cat food, beans, soup, meatballs, and so forth. I am passing this on to you because if I have to watch this anymore, I'm going to become a dedicated advocate of cable television, which is paid for so we don't have to look at all at the stupidity classified as advertising. I know someone has to pay to put television on the air, but once in a blue moon, couldn't we find enough patriotic people to say today is the 4th of July? Let the people see what is great about America and not what is great about Campbell's soup or a Goodyear tire. Now, this will get you. The letter was signed by Barry Goldwater. So you see what we have to put up with.
Robert Clemens of Nashville, who wants to know what steps an average citizen can take to make his concerns known.
Well, that's the only way we have been correcting it, by public opinion.
But what
if enough people will refuse to buy the products that are on the wrong programs, if enough people will write into their channels, into the broadcasting stations, local stations, complaining, that's the only way you'll ever get it done. It's the people that have to rise up and express themselves, and the only thing that will ever correct this is public opinion. I've said that all over the country.
Yeah.
Just to add to what Senator Pastore has said, about a month ago, J. Walter Thompson, the world's largest advertising agency, at a conference of advertisers here, showed the results of a study. It was a very tentative one, in which they had polled consumers in which at least 2 out of 10 were thinking of switching the figures. I haven't got the figures right, but at least there was a noticeable shift, enough to make advertisers worried, about people who decided not to buy a product because of being offended by violence on a certain show. And if you read advertising age, as I have to, you will find a marked tendency now on the part of advertising agencies and advertisers not to place their spots on shows that have undue amounts of violence. It's the marketplace. I know that's not a savory word, but it's the only way these things get decided in our system. And if you want to look at other broadcasting systems in this world, the French and others that are state operated, you will, with all of its faults, plump for the system we have in this country with alternatives.
Mrs. Summers of Silver Spring, who's worried about the elderly, the other side of the spectrum. She feels that the elderly who retire early are deprived of mature programs in the family hour, by the family hour. Sandy, you seem to react to that.
This is one of the most important issues that television has not yet confronted. You don't exist on television. Or if you do exist, you exist in a foolish manner. There is nothing that reflects either what older people might want to see or reflects them accurately in their older years. I do not know why this, yeah, I do know why this is so. Demographics, that's a code word for advertisers and the networks, where they go out for a young audience because they are the people with disposable incomes. And it's reflected not only in the kinds of people you see, but in very much in the age of people you see, especially on news programs. I remember once William Barry Furlong wrote a column about those announcers on the sidelines at ABC college football games. And his line was, ABC armed fetuses with microphones. The whole tendency is toward the glorification of the young marrieds, and the older people are forgotten. Because I think the feeling is they don't have the disposable income that advertisers are after. And it's therefore not reflected in programming. It's a disgrace.
I believe that it's a fallacy to assume that unless you have excessive gross violence, you can't have a program that satisfies the matured mind. I can't subscribe to that. The Mary Tyler Moore Show, the Waltons, those are fine programs. I think that some of our elderly enjoy those as well. Now, what we're trying to do here, you see, violence, in a sense, is an integral part of our lifestyle. And we've got to recognize that. What we're talking about is this gross violence, this extreme violence, in order to attract an audience to sell a product. Now, that's the violence we're talking about. Now, after all, I don't believe in blandness. I know that Sandy Van Oker is a very, very sophisticated person. I know that the person who asked the question is very sophisticated, and I believe I am, too. But the question here is that there was some garbage and some excessive violence being shown on television that is unacceptable by a lot of people. And I would do nothing. We talk about the competition of bringing CATV. Well, it's true, and pay television. I'm all for that kind of competition. But do you know that the elderly in the Rhode Island have sent me thousands of letters saying to me, do nothing to destroy free television? And that's what we don't want to do for the elderly, destroy free television. And that's the reason why I would assume that we could have the family hour, we can have matured programs, and then if it doesn't work, we could make a change. But this idea that we're going to rule it out because it's a showpiece just for kids is a fallacy. I see good programs between 7 and 9 o'clock, and I see some awful programs after 9 o'clock. And the point here is that there's got to be a responsibility someplace by somebody. And anybody that applies for that license, and it's a gold mine once you get it. These broadcasters and networks are not wanting for money. It's the pot of gold once you get that license. They pay nothing to get it, and then when they sell it, they get $20 million for them. And I'm saying they have a responsibility on the public airwaves to serve the public. And that's the name of the game.
We've had several questions dealing with pay TV and what it might mean. One puts it this way, is pay TV a must to improve what we see on television programs now? Another suggests that can we be sure that just because you pay for television, the caliber of the programs would go up at all? What's the response from both of you on that?
Well, the thing, I've said this 100 times. I'm all for pay TV. I'm all for CATV. But I want them to be competitive, but I don't want them to destroy free television. I don't want them to take up all the cream because they pay for it. Those the fine programs that we see today, and leave a lot of bland stuff for the people who cannot afford to pay that fee. Now, let's have competition. Let's encourage pay TV. Let's encourage CATV. But at the same time, don't let them suck off the cream and leave all the other stuff to the poor person who can't afford to pay that fee every month.
Sandy, do you think the level of television would be affected by pay TV?
I have no idea. I don't think that the people's motivation for pushing pay cable are any loftier or any more based than the people who run commercial networks. It's just a question of seeking profits. They say that they will offer alternative programming that will suit differing tastes. I don't know if they will. I think that the one thing that might be tried is a relaxation of the FCC rules and regulations on movies, which are the bread and butter of pay cable, and see how it works out. If it doesn't, then Congress can always act to change it. But I don't know. All I know is that the networks enjoy what approximates the nearest thing to a total monopoly of any industry in this country. If you don't like an American car, you can buy a Toyota or a Volkswagen. But apart from PBS, which I think is a very frail vessel, you don't have any alternate forms of broadcasting in this country except for a few places that already have pay cable.
Question from the left.
Marlene Cranin from East Lansing, Michigan, in Washington for the summer. I do not think that freedom should be a license for pollution, and I cannot understand why a very good U.S. senator should be able to bark and not bite, while the television should be holier than thou, and be able to dictate and also to bite. Now, there has been a very sharp increase in violent juvenile crime. Every night, the television provides a guidebook for our young people on how to commit all types of crime, showing precisely how to do another person in. Scientific studies show a strong correlation between violence on TV and violence in the streets. Why are the people who are trying to fight crime in the streets ignoring these lessons in crime on television? Also, there are many, many children without parents in the home. There is a huge divorce rate. The parents are working. The children have no models. For these children, TV is a school for life. That's where they learn about life. Should there not be a rotating citizens committee to set guidelines for antisocial and pro-social TV programming?
I think that's a brilliant idea, but I think that the networks and the broadcasters will have to set up their own committee. I don't think that you'll get away with it to compel the Congress to do it or try to get the Congress to do it. I don't think that the Supreme Court would sustain you. You know, I take it both ways. I have a lot of people criticizing me because I don't exercise enough muscle. Then every time I do, somebody says that it's the strong arm of the government, bureaucracy in all its powers. There's this fellow Connors, I think was the Mannix program. Yeah. He made a statement not too long ago. He's going to come here and punch me in the nose because he thinks I'm changing. For some reason, I'm thwarting his opportunity or his privilege to do his thing in his own way. John Lord on Hawaii Five has criticized me because they think that I'm butting in too much. Now you come along and you say I'm not butting in enough. And that's my life. And I get it both ways. Both ways.
Senator, have you thought about making it into a program? Sandy wants to speak to that.
You're doing something dangerous and you don't know it. You're lumping all the ills of this society implicitly, you didn't do it deliberately, on television, and it will not support that burden. I am prepared to agree that there may be a correlation between violence on television and violence in society. I am also prepared to submit that in the streets is a very vague phrase. You go out to suburbia, and there's an awful lot of crime out there, too. The product of kids who have been brought up in a rather more relaxed manner than we may have been brought up, who have cars, who've got money, and they've got idleness. I submit that is a possible cause of violence. The question of parents working is a product of our economy and the women's liberation movement. If television were not there, we do not know the behavioral patterns of those children. It is true they don't have role models, but I submit you're on a very dangerous trend if you really want to reach out and have what I call not the pressure groups like the United Church of Christ, Peggy Charon's action group on television, but self-appointed vigilante committees, you are going to get into trouble and violate the First Amendment.
Question.
Yes, I'm Towns Osborne from Washington, D.C., and there's a new organization in Washington called WATCH, the Washington Association for Television and Children, which is an outgrowth of ACT. I would like to address Mr. Pastore that do you feel that these concerned mothers who want to lobby for improved television for their children do make an impact, or do we cause too much pressure? Or
No, they have a tremendous impact. After all, as Sandy has pointed out, the networks in the broadcasting industry are in this to make some money. It's true that many of them are imbued with the Holy Spirit of serving the public, but the fact still remains that we have many, many mothers, many, many citizens group come before our committee. There's a young girl from Boston, I don't know what the name of it is offhand now, every time we have a hearing she comes, and I think it's had a tremendous impact. Let me tell you this story. I must tell you this story. We were discussing this matter of violence on television and the effect that it has on youthful minds. And one of the witnesses was the president of NBC, Mr. Goodman, Julius Goodman. So he was before the committee, and he did say to me, he says, the one prize thing that I have in my life is my seven-year-old boy. And he says, one Saturday morning, he said, I made it my business to turn on our programs to see what he was looking at. And he said, I was dismayed. Now, here's the president of NBC didn't know what his son was looking at. And he changed it because he had the ability to do it. As a matter of fact, during the Democratic convention, I met him in New York. And he says, you know, that seven-year-old boy is now 14-year-old, and you've been telling this story all over the country. And I said, I'll keep on telling it, too.
I'd like to put a line of questioning in another direction for a moment. We're going into another presidential campaign year. I'd like to know, Sandy, you've covered national political campaigns. Senator Pastore, you've been a campaigner low these years. Do you think that television's effect on politics has been beneficial or the opposite?
I will, too.
Why don't you go first?
Well, I think it has affected it in a very, very, very material way. As it has been said, television has become an integral part of our lifestyle. There's no question at all about it. Most people, and I think 96% of our population looks at television. I don't know what we would do without it. We don't do very good with it, but I don't know what we would do without it. And it does have, because it does have it does have an effect on educating people as to the issues, the personalities, and I think that it's gone a long, long way. The only trouble with it is it's become so expensive today that it's hard for most people to afford it. But the fact still remains that television today, without television, I hardly think that you could win a national office.
This is the problem as I see it. It certainly has had an effect. What kind of an effect, I don't think we know very much about. The social scientists are just beginning to turn their attention to this. Two professors at Syracuse, Patterson and McClure, have just published a book called The Unseeing Eye, which draws certain conclusions in the 72 campaign, which I think probably was not a very good campaign to draw conclusions from. But the whole question of the cost of getting on television. See, politicians are not sure what the effect of television is, but they dare not be without it. They dare not. It costs money. And why I happen to be opposed to the Campaign Reform Act is it didn't really treat the heart of the matter, which is cost as related to television. Carter has announced a budget of $8 to $10 million for television because he's working on a budget that is not much larger than when John F. Kennedy spent in 1960. I'm not sure that that is going to be enough from his point of view or whatever President Ford spends. So it seems to me the real issue is not coughing up more of our money, to pay for that commercial television advertisements, but to find out if there's some way that local stations and the networks will give it away gratis as part of a public service. Some stations do it. Some do it at the lowest prevailing commercial rate. But I think that is the heart of the matter. And I think that it's not beyond the bounds of reason that the networks and some local stations recognizing this problem might reach some agreement on it. But as Senator Pastore says, that's the heart of the problem, the cost of it.
But won't you admit, Sandy, that people would not have known Carter or Ford or Reagan or Mondale as well as they do if we didn't have television?
Oh, certainly.
Stands to reason. You hear them, and you can size them up better. You can listen to their issues. And I think that it has a far-reaching effect. There's no question at all about it. The only problem here is, how much does it cost? And what are we going to do about giving some free time to candidates for high political office? Now, I introduced a resolution in 1960 to relieve the presidential and vice presidential candidacies from the effects of Section 315, which is the equal time provision. Up to that time, the television, the networks were not giving any free time because you had so many candidates. And if they gave it to one, they'd have to give them to all, and it became so expensive, so they gave it to no one. So we introduced a resolution relieving the networks from the responsibility of Section 315 insofar as the presidency and the vice presidency is concerned. And that led to the Nixon-Kennedy debates that year. It was only because of that, otherwise we wouldn't have had that either. And it stands to reason that it was that television show that I think elected John Kennedy, without a question. And some people, of course, I'll tell you very frankly, some people can manage it very well and some people cannot. I doubt very much that Abraham Lincoln would have ever been elected President of the United States if he had television in his day.
But, Senator, don't we now have the phenomenon, the contemporary phenomenon of packaging so that it, in order to get on the nightly news shows, much of campaigning is really a television media event?
That's right. That's right. But you see, television, no matter who it is or how it is, it's still television.
But I'm not sure the advent of the telegraph system in this country didn't change political campaigning.
Sure. And newspapers.
And, you know, if television networks do not want to go for the media event that's being staged by the candidate's advisor, they don't have to do it.
All right, back to our audience for questions on the left here.
Mrs. Percy Leon from Sarasota, Florida. I'm afraid my question will seem a little bland after all the discussion about violence on television. In England, the BBC examines announcers and sees that they speak a proper English. What worries me is not what the dear little tots are seeing about sex and violence. They know more than we do already. What worries me is the pronunciation that many fairly important news announcers use. Incidentally, there's an advertisement that has some violence in it that I wouldn't want a child of mine to see because it would get the wrong idea of how to handle its life. But what about it, Senator and Mr. Van Oka?
What?
A regulation of English?
I make a fetish of enunciation. And I have instilled that in my children as well. Now, I think that the laxity there, if it does exist, is on the part of the networks and the broadcasting institution that hires these people. I think they ought to be an example of good English. I go along with you on that. Now, how much it is a responsibility of the Joint Commerce Committee on Communications, I don't know. But As I dare say, we don't have any such authority. But I quite agree with you. The best English ought to be spoken in public, whether it be on television, whether it be in the street, whether it be in this room, or any place else. And we ought to be careful with our children that they do pronounce their INGs, that they do enunciate correctly, that they do not use four-letter words, that they do use decent English. I agree with you. But whether or not that's the responsibility of my subcommittee or a national responsibility is another thing.
Sandy, you want to comment on the...
Well, the BBC is so precise about this. In the days before World War II, the man who read the 9 o'clock news had to be dressed in a dinner jacket for radio. I think one of the saddest commentaries is that the man who uses the language with the utmost precision, Edwin Newman, is a man we don't see too much of on television. We see him occasionally, but I offer his example. Because if Edwin Newman, when he came to NBC, was not carrying Fowler's correct usage and Strunk's elements of style and George Orwell's essay, Politics in the English Language, it was only because Ed had read them. With some of these furry people that you see on television now, I'm not sure if you gave them those two books in one essay, they could read them. That's a problem for the networks, not the Congress.
Well, not only that, if I may add this, I mean, now, let's not be partial. You named NBC. Nothing wrong with Walter Cronkite Eric Severide. They're pretty good, too.
I want just to put a footnote there, having just come back from an assignment in Plains, Georgia. You've got to decide who decides which is the way you should sound. Let's have a question on the right.
I'm Brad Glazier from Syracuse. This question is also in a little bit of a different vein. Mr. Van Oker, as a television journalist, let me ask you this. How do you feel about reporters that will not be in commercials for their networks because it attaches a certain legitimacy to the product or service? I'm thinking of Tom Brokaw. There may be others I don't know of, but how do you feel about that?
Well, I think they're absolutely right. When I was enjoying a sabbatical that had been arranged for me by Richard Nixon in broadcasting, I was approached by an advertising agency asking me if I would be interested in doing commercials for Ford Granada. And an awful lot of money was involved. And I had certain very serious obligations at the time. But I knew what they wanted, and I don't blame them for it. They were one of the few people who even got in touch with me at the time. But I said no, because I knew what they were buying. And once I had sold it, I'd never get it back again. So I didn't do it. So I think it's probably a very useful thing for television news personnel to stay away from that. And I wrote about that when Barbara Walters was doing it on the Today Show and then turning up on Meet the Press. I argued that NBC wanted to have it both ways. Now she's relieved of that. So I think that it's very useful not to have that. But again, the networks, not CBS and ABC had a rule about it. NBC now has, I take it, such a rule. The networks have permitted people who do sports to do commercials. Now, I happen to think sports reporting is as demanding and as important in terms of accuracy as news reporting. It is news. But you will see any number of sports announcers doing commercials. I think it lessens their efficacy and credibility.
We've had a number of questions dealing with public television. Most of them, Sandy, referring to the lack of challenge that you mentioned. What's the answer to competition? Perhaps since you were intimately involved with public television, you'd like to address yourself to that.
One has to be very careful in this regard, because public broadcasting has really had a good thumping over nearly a decade now, money in one thing and another. But my complaint about television, public broadcasting, now that the money problems seem to be solved, is that they really can't decide what they want to be. It often struck me when I was in public broadcasting, and admittedly there's a lot of pressure on the people, mostly because of my presence there, that they like to have a lot of meetings. Now, I've always thought the meetings were an institution designed to prevent decisions from being made. And I often thought that public broadcasting was a large number of meetings surrounded by an occasional program. But it seems to me that public broadcasting can't plead congressional interference now. They can't plead lack of money. They can't plead White House interference. What I think they have to do is to get busy and decide what it is public broadcasting wants to do. Instead of going and always showing you what great equipment they have, they're marvelous about that, they have to decide what it is they want to do. And until they do it, I don't think we're going to have decent public broadcasting. They spend most of their time arguing with each other.
Senator, have you got any thoughts on public broadcasting?
Well, as a matter of fact, I was the one who introduced the bill. I'm the one who managed it on the floor of the Senate, and possibly could be considered as the father of public broadcasting or educational broadcasting. I think it serves a purpose. There was a time when there was White House interference, Andy. I mean, they were finding fault with the fact that there were certain programs that they thought were inimical to the administration of Nixon at the time. And they wanted to hold up the authorization, make it 1 year. We tried so desperately hard to explain that if you're going to have a good format, it takes about 2 to 3 years to put it together. And that they needed an authorization of a longer period of time. Now, we've been able to accomplish that. And we've been able to get more money. We've just passed a bill only a short while ago. And I quite agree with you that with the proper amount of funding, a good job can be done by public broadcasting. And as the law is now written now, 35% of the money that we do give has to go to the local stations. And I think it does serve a good purpose. And we've got to remember this, that for every dollar that we pay out of the federal treasury, they have to come up with $2.50 to add to it.
We have a question on the left.
Yes, I'm Mark Bonanno, and I'm age 17, and I'm from Arlington, Virginia, which is no more than 200 yards across the Potomac River out there. And I've been hearing a lot about sex and violence on TV and how it's affecting the younger generation. Well, I'd like to say I'm part of the younger generation, and in my high school, there's everything from an attempted rape right on up to drugs. And I just feel that it hasn't come from television by the fact that there are bad programs on TV. It's come from the television that the fact the parents aren't taking any kind of interest in what their children are watching. My TV has a power button, which means it can be turned on and off, which means there can be nothing on it. And my TV also has a channel selector switch, which means there's a variety of channels you can put on there, which means you don't have to watch the sex and the violence. And I also have a radio, which has no sex and violence on it. And it just behooves me, you know, to see that all these people, and I haven't seen one person under 20 get up here and say this, I don't think there's anything wrong with the people of today that there weren't back in my father's time or in any of your time.
Well, we have a lot of decent kids today. Let no one make any mistake about that. The trouble is, the good things about our society are not news. The bad things usually are. And that's true in every facet of our society. And I think, like Barry Goldwater said here, let's have more about what's good about America. And I think we ought to bear that in mind. Only the other day we had these Girl State, sponsored by the American Legion Auxiliary, and we had the Boy State. You never saw a group of cleaner, fresher-looking, intelligent, well-dressed young people than at that meeting that was up there at the Capitol. And I'm telling you, it's a credit to the United States of America. And this idea that because we have some street crime, every young kid is a criminal is a lot of baloney.
I want to get in a couple more questions that were sent up on cards. One has to do with television reruns. It's from Victor Coles of Arlington, Virginia. Now that the FCC has decided not to act on the number of television reruns, will Congress or the FCC reconsider action on the excessive amount of old material bringing revenue to the networks? Sandy, as a critic, what do you think of television reruns, which begin, I believe, in March and go through September now, till September?
Yeah, I don't like them, but I don't want Congress or the FCC to do anything about it. I want competitive pressure to change it. Now, look, they're in those reruns, one, because it's very costly to program 39 weeks as they used to do. Secondly, it is very tough to feed that box week after week, day after day, hour after hour. You are seeing some trends in the network, and I would say the Olympics, it's a fortuitous development, is part of a new way of presenting summer fare, of the networks trying out different forms within the summer. But it's going to take some time, but I think it has to be worked out in a competitive way, and I just don't think the FCC or the Congress ought to get involved in it.
There's been some other questions dealing with the FCC and licensing, and one of our audience, Susan Bishop, wonders if tighter licensing procedures might do something about changing the programming, improving the programming.
Well, you see, the FCC is now being criticized. They're in court now because of the Family Hour in California. You see, you're on a very sensitive, in a very sensitive area. How far you can go in telling the media just what it must show or cannot show. As a matter of fact, the law prohibits it. I think the Supreme Court would sustain that. There's no question about that. I repeat again, it's a matter of public opinion. These people are in the business to make money. And if the consumer, the public, will stand up and make itself heard, I think that's the only way to correct it. The only way you can correct it.
But, Senator, wouldn't you agree that the FCC, and it may be for compelling reasons, has been very reluctant to deny license renewal to TV stations? I think one, Mississippi, Jackson, Mississippi, was the outstanding example, but it's very reluctant.
I think that was even I don't know if that was a television station, much as it was a radio station.
No, it was a television station, and it had a great deal to do with attitude toward blacks. But you see, if a really outrageous performance by one television station in this country, truly outrageous, found the FCC in a clear-cut position to deny license renewal, I guarantee you that would have a more salutary influence on other stations around the country, or a series of them, two or three, than any amount of pressure, or anything that I might write, Senator Pastore might say in committee hearings. That would do it, because you see, that gets these gentlemen where they really live, right in the pocketbook.
That's right.
one short last question from Alice Plystead of Washington. Sandy, you mentioned the Olympic coverage a moment ago. She wants to know what can be done in the future at the Olympics to eliminate talking heads like Cosell, O.J. Simpson, Rigby, and the others.
Laryngitis is the only thing I can think of.
Thank you. We'll all look forward to laryngitis in another 4 years. Thank you all for coming today to participate in National Town Meeting. Thank you, Senator Pastore, Sandra Van Oker. Next week, National Town Meeting will be held in the Kennedy Center Opera House at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday. The topic will be crime and punishment. The panelists, former Governor of California Edmund G. Pat Brown, Richard Veldy, Chief Administrator of the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, and Representative Robert Drynan, Democrat of Massachusetts. The moderator will be John McKenzie of the Washington Post. Thank you again for coming.
Thus, the conclusion of this National Town Meeting, the topic of which was television, American dream or nightmare. The principal speakers, once again, were Senator John Pastore, Democrat of Rhode Island, and television critic Sandra Van Oker. The moderator was Bonnie Angelo of Time Magazine.